Good morning, everybody. I'm so glad to be back. I have just been miserable, basically, since Saturday with this darn summer cold or spring cold or whatever you call it. You know, the minute it gets warm, all those cold germs start circulating around, and I caught them. And thanks to Scott Hardy for filling in so ably for me on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in the Mary Griffith Show. But I am back now, a little bit snuffly. So I'm sorry about that, but you know what I missed the most while I was gone? My Harvest Ridge coffee. The first thing I did when I got to work this morning was put up a pot of Harvest Ridge. I was forced to go to Mountain Dew, and that's okay. I love my Mountain Dew, but nothing like Harvest Ridge coffee from Refreshment Services Pepsi. Thanks to them for sponsoring the Mary Griffith Show. Today we're going to talk politics, and it's an important political issue. The citizens of Quincy have a decision to make. They're going to elect a mayor on April 1st. Will they return to office, the incumbent Republican Mike Trope, or will they elect independent candidate Dr. Linda Moore? We're going to talk with Dr. Linda Moore today about her candidacy. Welcome to the Mary Griffith Show.
Thanks for having me, Mary. I'm glad you're feeling better.
I am feeling better, and I wouldn't have missed this. I would have dragged myself out, you know, for this. And then tomorrow we've got Chuck and Jack Freiberg. So, you know, I mean, that's the favorite day of all for me. So, Dr. Linda Moore, let's get started. You've talked about a fix or flatten program. Before we get into the details of that, a lot of people are curious about you. You were a small town girl in Quincy, moved away, made a big splash in the world of ESPN. A lot of guys would love to have had your job, that's for sure. Unusual for a woman to have had your post. And then, like many people, my husband, others, they came back to Quincy because they needed to take care of their aging parents. So give us a brief synopsis of your life in Quincy, your life away, and what made you return.
Sure. Well, I've always loved Quincy. I grew up here. When I graduated from high school, I was a graduate of Payson Seymour High School, class of 78. Go Indians. And then decided to go to John Wood because I really wasn't sure what direction I was going to go. I had thought about everything from home economics to fashion design to business administration to teaching, math. So I went to John Wood and then to Quincy College at the time. I realized that what I really wanted to do was go into business. So while I was at QU, I met Jim Mantesti, who was the alumni director at the time, and Frank Longo, who was working part-time in sports information but also the assistant men's soccer coach. They both kind of took me under their wing and taught me a lot about public relations, communications, writing press releases, working with the press. So I really decided that if I could go into the sports world in business, that would be the ideal. And I always said by the time I was 30, I wanted to be the director of marketing for a major sports organization. So after college, I became a college recruiter, worked for McMurray College in Jacksonville, then Culver Stockton in Canton, Missouri, then the U.S. Sports Academy in Mobile, Alabama, actually Daphne, Alabama, the East Shore. And at the Sports Academy, while I was getting my master's degree, they asked me to run the Missouri Sport Education Center, which was located at Fontbonne College at the time. And my job was to basically recruit coaches and athletic directors to get a master's degree so that then they would get a higher pay scale. And during that, I met a lot of people. I served on the first St. Louis Sports Commission, so I was a charter member of that. We brought in a lot of Olympic events and a lot of qualifying events. I worked on a number of those kind of events. Did the Olympic Festival in 1994, worked in the logistics area. I was the trash and portageon queen. Not very glamorous, but somebody had to do it.
What a great title.
You know,
did you have your own business card? Porta-potty queen.
Yeah. You know, I could tell you how many porta-johns you needed for how many people, for how many hours of every event. But I learned a lot. From there, I went to Denver for the Olympic Festival in 1995 and then was recruited to the Olympics in 96 in Atlanta. Well, while I was at the Olympics, my job during the games was at the main operations center or mission control. The FBI sat at a desk behind me. You know, we always had dignitaries walking through. Chelsea Clinton, I think, was there every other day, you know, but the Clintons came and just so many other dignitaries from around the world. There were 27 big screen TVs in front of me. So I got to see every minute of every sports competition for that games. I'd work a 36-hour shift, take a few hours off, come back, work 36 hours more. So Mountain Dew and Snickers bars kept me going.
Well, you've only got that brief time that the Olympics are on, so you can't just work a regular 8-hour day. Yeah,
that's right. So then as the Olympics were winding down, it was like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do now? Well, what do you do after you've done the Olympics if you're a sports fan? So a friend of mine that I worked with in St. Louis called and said, I have this job for you in San Diego on the beach. It's probably beneath you, but if you want to do it for a couple of years, come on out. So I decided 2 years on the beach sounded pretty good. I was 36 at the time, so I was like, why not? I'll get a real job then in 2 years. Well, I fell in love with the X Games, and my first job was to take care of the athletes. I manage their housing, their travel, their transportation, their prize money distribution, their credentials, all of their catering. You know, so I really got to know them, and my first reaction was shock. These weren't the athletes that I knew from the Olympic movement. Most of them were misunderstood children, 12 to 15 years old, and they really just needed a mother figure. So I kind of became the mom. And I just, the athletes at that point, I just love them, you know, and I grew up with them. I felt like they were my kids. You know, Tony Hawk was there, and I watched him grow up. Now he's got kids in that age range, and every once in a while he or Dave Mira would say something like, was I that way when I was that age? Oh, yeah, they were worse. But they really were just misunderstood people who really had a passion for what they did. Well, I never left the X Games. You know, I was 2 years in San Diego, 2 years in San Francisco. I went to Philadelphia for a while, and then they moved me to the headquarters in Bristol, Connecticut. That's where my career really took off because I became involved in all of the original entertainment that ESPN did at the time. I worked a lot on the ESPY Awards. That was a big one for me because we were trying to turn around the financials. Anytime we did, like Playmakers, Around the Horn, 50, E60, 30 for 30 ESPN Films, those were all brands that I helped develop and manage from the financial side. I did the contracts, the hiring, the staffing plans, and really worked closely with legal and HR to make sure we could get the programs on the air, then worked with our CFO, Christine Dreesen, and finance to figure out how are we going to pay for it, what do we need, what does the business model look like, to make sure it was profitable and we could continue it on.
What kind of budgets were you overseeing at that time? Because ESPN's a pretty tall cotton.
Yeah. And in the early 2000s, money really wasn't an object. You know, at that point, we were returning, you know, 10, 12, 15, 20% to stakeholders. So it was easy to find money. After 9/11, it started getting a little bit tighter. So we started managing things a little bit closer. But I've managed budgets anywhere from... We started the Global X Games with $148 million and ended up had to get it down to $78 million. So that was a lot of money to cut, but we found a way to do it even though we were operating in four different countries, four different languages, four different, you know, monetary systems. So it's just a matter of finding the fluff and figuring out what's a need and what's a want.
Yeah, and, you know, some things are fluff. If you can afford them, have all the fluff you want. If you can't afford it, you can't have fluff. That leads us on, we'll get to that in a moment, because some people think there's a lot of fluff in the Quincy City budget. Others say not so much fluff. But so you're out there, you're successful, everything's going great, and then you probably get a phone call.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my career really developed at ESPN, and it grew. I also, you know, handled ESPN the magazine for a while, ESPN Enterprises, which was the commercial products and the consumer products. So I did a lot of different things depending on where they needed a fixer. You know, so
and that's where you kind of get the reputation for being a problem solver. Jump right in, fix the problem, don't point fingers.
Right. Probably... The one accomplishment that I think means the most to me, George Bodenheimer, the president at the time, came to me and he said, I need you to get involved with the ESPYs. It's losing money. We need you to not only make it profitable, but we need to figure out a way to fund the V Foundation for Cancer Research at a much higher level. Can you find a way to make $1 million for the V Foundation through the SB golf program? And I said, well, give me a couple years, but I think so. And so in year two, we raised $1 million from the golf event. And, you know, presenting that check to the V Foundation just felt so good because I had lost friends to cancer years earlier and just never felt I could do enough. So that was closure for me, that I felt like I was doing something to impact the future for anybody who struggles or goes through cancer. And the research is what gets us the cures.
And so the V Foundation continues to exist today, and you had a big hand in that. That's fantastic. Well, we don't want to run out of time on your exploits in Stanford, Connecticut. Not that they're not lovely, but at some point in time, you decided to return to Quincy, as many people do, because you had a call home.
Right. My father had a heart attack in 2007. The doctor said he might have 5 years. Well, I could see I would come home about every month or 6 weeks just to visit for a weekend. And I could tell my mom was getting really tired from caring for dad. I had my 55 and out plan all along. So I had told my executive vice president that, you know, once I turn 55, I'm out. And he kept saying, no, no, no. And I said, yes, yes, yes. So that summer when I turned 55, I knew I was going to be leaving sometime in the next year. And I stayed in until November, and then it just felt like I need to go now. So I came home, and luckily my dad had a few more years. I don't regret coming home and spending time with him. I helped mom a lot, of course. I also started volunteering a lot for a lot of local organizations. When I got to the point where I was volunteering 40, 50, 60 hours a week, I decided, you know what, if I'm going to work this much, maybe I need to think about going back to work. You know, I didn't really need to, but I just felt like maybe it's the right time. I had thought about politics. I actually was invited to the Yale Women's Campaign School at Yale Law School in 2013. It's a week-long program, a nonpartisan group. They have generally 75 women. A third are usually Democrats, a third are usually Republicans, and a third might be independent or international. My executive coach at the time was on their board and said, Linda, I really think you should go to this. Just go as a leadership opportunity. So she finally talked me into it. I went, and I so love the fact that Democrats and Republicans could actually work together. They were sharing lists, sharing information, and that was something that was very novel to me. And of course, today, it's very novel to have Republicans and Democrats working together. Instead, we're in an us versus them society. But it was really refreshing to see that it can happen. And having been through that, I know it can happen again.
We're talking with Dr. Linda Moore. She's the independent candidate for Quincy's mayor, and voting is underway right now. Election Day is on April 1st. Several things have come up that people have asked me about, and I say, I don't know. You know, I'll ask when she's on my show. You mentioned coming home to take care of an ailing father, and now, of course, your mother still is alive and pretty good shape, but there have been rumors that you're in ill health. Dr. Linda Moore, would you like to either confirm or dispel? How is your health?
My health has never been better. Dr. Cricard actually fixed my knees. I had knee replacement about 3 years ago, and that has made a world of difference for me. I'm probably in better shape than I've been since I was 36 years old and at the Olympics. And my mother will turn 90 on Monday. So if you see her out and about between now and Monday, wish her happy birthday. I'm so proud of her. She is doing absolutely wonderful.
We're going to have to take a break for the farm markets, but you come back to Quincy, you say, I might as well be working full time. How did you then get into politics? Because your first venture into Quincy politics was not as a running person, but as an appointed person. And a lot of people might be surprised to know that even though we have partisan politics in Quincy, you were appointed by a Republican for a Democratic seat. Tell us how that happened.
Correct. I had met with the Democratic Central Committee because they had wanted me to run for mayor against Kyle Moore. And I wasn't ready to run for mayor. I hadn't been back long enough, and I felt like I needed to learn more about the city and about the residents because I had been away for so long, even though I came back a lot on weekends. But I met with them and talked with them, and they asked me that if I were to ever get a position, would I run for re-election then as a Democrat? And I said, well, I can make that promise. If I am appointed as a Democrat, I will run for re-election as a Democrat. I really didn't know, though, if I wanted to be part of the Democratic Party or not, because my values didn't really align 100% with the Democrats, but they didn't align with the Republicans either. So I decided I needed to be fair. I needed to talk to some Republicans. I did, and I just felt they were nasty. They were mean. They were ugly. They were nasty. Every time I brought up a name about people that I might consider, I just didn't like the feeling I got when I was around them. So I decided the local Republican Party at that time probably was not for me. And so when Chuck Schultz came to me and said, hey, Peggy Krim wants to retire. We need somebody to be the treasurer, and with your finance background, we think you'd be great. I said no twice, you know, and I think people know this story. But when he came to me the third time, I couldn't say no a third time to Chuck Schultz. So I said yes. Then I met with Kyle Moore, who was mayor, and we sat down and talked, and we got along very well. And we got along very well for the entire time I served with him, and I still talk to him. In fact, I've talked to him twice this week. So he and I have a lot of common values, even though we're not related. We both graduated from Quincy University, but you know, that's about it. We are not related, but we do share a lot of common values where we value the working family, we value our veterans, we value our service leaders, and so we got along fine, and he appointed me.
Because the appointment open was a Democratic appointment, the mayor traditionally agrees to appoint someone under the D marker for that. And so Kyle Moore did that, and you didn't have any trouble working with him as a Republican. Again, you're a co-office holder, so he wasn't your boss, but you had to work very closely. Now, again, the treasurer doesn't really control the budget. That's more the comptroller's job.
That's correct.
But we'll talk about what you did when you got into the treasurer's office, because no matter what has been done well, there's always improvements that can be made. We're going to take a break. When we come back, our conversation with Dr. Linda Moore, independent candidate for Quincy Mayor, will continue. We'll head up to the Ursa Farmers Cooperative to see what's happening on the farm markets, and we'll be right back. You stay tuned, continuing our conversation with Dr. Linda Moore. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD at 943. My guest today, Dr. Linda Moore. We left off. She'd been appointed as the city treasurer. She was under the leadership, the administrative leadership of Kyle Moore, and got along well with Mayor Moore. And then tell us a little bit about what you did as treasurer and why you decided to leave the treasurer's post early.
Sure. So the job of the treasurer is to collect the money, to deposit the funds, and then to invest any idle funds. So one of the things I started doing was taking the idle cash, monitoring cash flow, and taking the idle cash, working with the banks to put it into CDs or money markets to increase the amount of interest. Because at the time, we were looking at a future where budgets were going to get tighter, and I knew every dollar I could invest or every dollar I could make from investments would be a dollar we didn't have to tax. So I started working with all of the banks locally to try to find ways that we could increase the interest income on those funds. So we started out, you know, I think when I took over, we were making about $89,000 a year in investment income. and the market helped us because interest rates started rising. But by year seven, we were up to about $2.5 million in interest income. Wow. And it just became a matter of monitoring cash flow more closely. The other thing that I did, my constituents, especially the hotel motel owners, wanted an easier, more convenient way to pay their taxes. And we were collecting, you know, $1 million plus from the hotel motel tax every year. They had to fill out a form, write a check, mail it, or drop it off before 4:30 on the last business day of the month. They wanted to be able to do it online. So we found an online system, implemented that, got 100% compliance almost immediately. It was especially helpful for out-of-town hotel motel owners because they could do it from wherever they were, and we'd get the money faster and on time. Then a little bit later, a lot of our water customers said, couldn't we have a more user-friendly platform? And we'd been looking for a couple of years for the right platform. We came across a company called Invoice Cloud. They did a lot of other cities our size around the country. So we worked with them, talked to them, played with their system a little bit, and realized, yes, this was a way for us to give our water customers a platform that they could control and manage their own accounts. So we implemented that, and I think that helps a lot as well. The other thing I tried to do is empower our employees to make decisions so that everything didn't have to wait until the treasurer made the decision, and I let them handle their own areas and empowered them to make decisions that were appropriate for their level. And I think that really boosted morale in the office.
And then you eventually left the treasurer's mm-hmm. office early. And this has been a concern of people who are like, will she serve her full term as mayor? Mm-hmm. But the reason you left was because you saw an opportunity where you could run for mayor, and you didn't mm-hmm. want to run for mayor while you're being paid by the taxpayers to be the city treasurer. So there is this moment, and probably one of the moments that you and Mayor Trope most disagree on, what happened, and that's mm-hmm. okay. I'm not here to arbitrate who's right or who's wrong, but there was a serious problem with the employee insurance program. Mm-hmm. You tried to go from self-insurance, which was a losing factor, to a premium-based third-party insurer, and things didn't quite run as smoothly mm-hmm. as I'm sure everyone had wished. And talk a little bit about what that happened, because to me, in the debate that I saw that I, you know, was in, and in other places I've seen you speak and him speak, this seems to be a big point of, I handled it this way, Trope handled it this way, which way would you rather have it handled? This is a method for people to decide which was the most appropriate way to handle the situation.
Sure. The year before, we had excess claims. And we had to move over $2 million into the health insurance fund to cover the claims. It was a very bad claims year. Well, when you are self-insured, you know that your claims can go up and down. You know, one year you can have a bad year because you have a lot of incidents and a lot of health issues. The next year, maybe not so much. So the budget was pretty flat to the budget the year before, even though we had to add all that money at the end. Mayor Trope was right there. That is true. But what didn't go so well is the process for changing from that self-insured to a fully insured with an HRA. There is about an 8-page process in place that when we want to change health insurance because of all the collective bargaining agreements, there's a process to go through, and you have to give a 60-day notice to the unions. Well, the 60-day notice was, I think, 61 days. So there really wasn't a lot of time. It was never fully explained to people what an HRA really meant to them. And an HRA, by definition, is a health reimbursement account. So you pay for your claim, and then you get reimbursed from the HRA. That's how it's supposed to work. Our employees, and especially the unions, didn't want that. They wanted things paid up front like it had been before. So that was the point of contention, and the communication was not there. The other issue was that the insurance company was given a list of insureds on December 27th for it to go into effect on January 1st. Well, on a Friday afternoon, for things to go into effect the next week, that just wasn't going to happen. So that didn't happen. So that started the issues. And from there, it just kept getting worse and worse. We had employees who were sent to collections because they hadn't paid a claim, even though they had never received a bill themselves. We had service providers who were getting chunks of money with no explanation of what accounts it should go to. We had employees who went for an appointment and were told they weren't covered on insurance. So there were a number of issues, and it was a very complex. There was a lot of finger pointing in, I think it was July of 23. That's when it really got bad. There was the vote of no confidence, first from the police and then, of course, from the city council. And it just kept going on and on and on. So fast forward to later that fall, we still didn't have answers. And there were a number of meetings about, you know, what went wrong, how to fix it. And I kept seeing people just point the finger, you know, oh, well, it must be their fault. Oh, it must be their fault. And nobody was standing up saying, let's just fix it. So finally, I just stood up and probably interrupted in a not so polite way and said, get out of my way. I will fix it. So the first thing I did that afternoon was get HIPAA certified, so that I could even have access to the information. And I had already gone through Coalition's statements to find every dollar that we paid to Coalition Health. And they were probably part of the problem because Mr. Baxter was not a communicator. He's a software analyst. We could also never figure out who the broker was. And I still, to this day, don't know who the insurance broker was. Was commission paid to anybody? I don't know. I can't answer that. I did not find it in what research I did on Coalition, but Coalition had a number of clients. So, you know, I wouldn't have seen 100% of their books. So that was part of the issue. And just because of the number of employees who were impacted by this, it was a debacle. It was a mess. Did we save $1 million? Yes, we did. We saved $1 million off of the year before. Did we save $1 million off of the budget? No, because it wasn't budgeted. That is true. It all goes back to, it was probably a good idea to make the change, but how the change was handled and how it was communicated is where the problems began. You know, and that's kind of a pattern. It's the transparency, it's the communication, it's the process that was broken.
Okay. Dr. Linda Moore, my guest today. You know, everybody wants their streets fixed, but nobody wants to pay any more in taxes. So, Dr. Linda Moore, I'm sure you have an answer. How are you magically going to repair all the streets and do it for no money? I mean, it is, everybody talks about the streets in Quincy, and it is important. So that's one thing that I think probably everybody cares about is how. What is your action plan for repairing streets?
Sure. And it's not going to be no money. It's going to be the money that we have. That's what we have to use. No more. I'm a taxpayer too, and I can't afford more property taxes. We're taxed enough. So I want to do it within the budgets we have, much like I did when I was at ESPN. We didn't always get more money. We had to figure out how to deliver the rating that we needed with the budget that we had. So I want to look at processes. Anyone who is in like manufacturing or industrial, you know, they have Lean Six and Six Sigma and all these different ways to look at processes. We need to look at our processes. How are we doing things, and how can we do them more efficiently? It's not about having more money. It's probably not about having more bodies. It's how do we take the resources we have to deliver what we need to deliver. So I've made the promise that all of the potholes are going to be patched and fixed in the first 100 days. That's a simple Band-Aid. That's all that is. But once they're fixed, at least we're not losing a small child or a tire in a pothole. From there, then, we have to take a look at the optics. You know, a lot of money has been spent to repair our roads, but if you look around, you don't see it. we need to take a portion of our budget to resurface streets when it costs less. When you have to rebuild a whole street, it's extremely expensive. So instead of letting all of our streets get so bad that we have to build them over, let's resurface the ones that we can resurface and keep them in good enough condition that we don't constantly have to replace the roads. If we can spend a portion of our budget there and then take the rest of the budget and upgrade the streets by reconstructing where we need to, eventually we'll get them all done. It's not going to happen overnight. It's probably not going to happen in 4 years, but we're going to show every year the progress we're making, and we will have a report card on the website that's user-friendly that people can see, yep, it's moving, we're doing good, or, oh, wait, it hasn't moved in 6 months. What's going on?
One of the problems, very briefly, is state roads, county roads, city roads, the average person driving on them doesn't know.
Exactly.
People complain here, you know, about, you know, 4th Street. Well, 4th Street is a city or is a state highway. So, mm-hmm. you know, don't talk to me about the pothole there. Mm-hmm. The city of Quincy's truck isn't going to fill it. So that's one of the problems, is just not knowing which are the city's responsibilities. Before we run out of time, though, I do want to give you a chance to ask for people to vote for you and talk about the number one thing you think needs to change and happen in Quincy.
Sure. Well, the number one thing is we've got to change the culture. You know, and that takes time. But in working with our employees through the insurance situation, I found that we have employees who really are in their job because they want to serve the public. And so we need to get everybody on the same page, serving the public and getting the job done. That's going to be a big one. You know, our infrastructure is a big one, and we have a lot of deadlines. The financial system, you know, we need a sustainable financial model that's going to take us well into the future, despite the fact that we know PPRT is going to go up and down. There are other revenues that are going to go up or down. We need something that's sustainable. The other big issue we have is housing. You know, we have a housing crisis in this city, and no one person, no one organization is going to fix it. I want a strategic task force appointed that includes those organizations that have boots on the ground that work with people on a daily basis. I want builders, I want developers, I want landlords, tenants, anybody who's got a stake in the game, probably banks too, because they loan money. We have a problem with affordable housing and not having enough, not only renters, but homeowners.
But let me interrupt you for a
sure.
minute. We just had this problem out at 49th and Columbus mm-hmm. Road, where an out-of-town person whose neighbor was a Quincyan said, oh, we need housing in Quincy. You ought to think about building your apartment complexes mm-hmm. there. And it was, you know, not in my backyard. And we've mm-hmm. seen this happen over and over again. How do you reach out to a developer like that who is willing to sink 270 apartment units, was willing to make that kind of investment, and maybe get them to change from an apartment model to maybe a home ownership model? How do you do that? Because nobody wants the housing next to them, but everybody says we need housing.
Well, and I don't think it's nobody wants it. I think we have to put it in the right place. We have been expanding the city's footprint for years and years and years, and yet our population hasn't grown. We need to look more at infill housing. And how do we take the vacant lots and the empty spaces and put structures there that can either be for homeowners or for renters? And we have to match the neighborhoods to the project. That particular situation, I think it was partly we have a new director of planning and development that maybe didn't think about the fact that our ordinance says you only have to notify people within a short distance.
Right.
You know,
it went from nobody.
It
went
that.
From nobody is yeah. against this to 300 people are against
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Well,
you know, and that's an easy fix, just changing the ordinance for rural areas.
Yeah. My husband and I had a fight, and you know, again, we're just 5 feet away from where we had to get notified. If our neighbors hadn't told us, we wouldn't have known. Right. I want to give you 1 minute to give your pitch. Give
sure.
everybody a chance to ask for a vote.
Sure. I am a firm believer that we have to fix what's broken first. We can fix what's broken, and then we can grow what's possible. We need to take care of what we have, take care of our small business owners, take care of our local residents and homeowners and tenants. We need to take care of the people that make Quincy so great. So I'm asking for your vote between now and April 1st. Election Day is April 1st. vote for Linda Moore for mayor. And thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you.